Athens News Matters is sponsored in part by the WUGA Community Advisory Council, dedicated and involved individuals who help WUGA stay connected with our listeners, community organizations, and issues in the Athens area. Learn more at WUGA.org.
Today on Athens News Matters, kids as young as 5 can get a COVID vaccine, but many parents are hesitating. Meanwhile, more than a few grown-ups are increasingly confused about getting a COVID booster.
So the CDC chose the wording of certain groups should be vaccinated with the booster, and other groups may be vaccinated with the booster.
A vaccine expert joins us to answer the latest batch of vaccine questions. This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Also today, the fight for justice in the Morris Ford lynching continues, with new developments in the effort to have grand jury testimony unsealed.
Over 100 people testified before a grand jury back in the 40s about what they knew about this crime.
Plus, our panel breaks down the week in news.
Those stories and more coming up on Athens News Matters.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London.
Reporting from bunkers, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA News. I'm Chris Shoup. As vaccines and booster shots continue to become readily available, more than half of the country is now fully vaccinated. On October 29th, the FDA authorized emergency use of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children 5 through 11 years old. Additionally, an FDA official states authorizing booster shots for all vaccinated adults is a high priority. Dr. Ashley Hannings is a professor in the University of Georgia College of Pharmacy and is here to give us updates on the vaccine and booster shots. Welcome back to Athens News Matters.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by discussing the kid versions of the COVID-19 vaccine. What is the specific CDC guidance on vaccines for children over 5 years of age?
So yes, this is something that just recently happened. So the Pfizer vaccine for COVID-19 can now be used in children that are aged 5 to 11. And it should be noted that it is a different formulation and a different dosage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's less than what we give to adults. But you pretty much, if you fall into that age range, are eligible to get it unless you have some kind of like contraindication. So if like you're allergic to something that's in the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, anyone who is in that age range can now get the vaccine.
So what do you make of almost half of parents not supporting the vaccine for their kids, according to a new Gallup poll?
Yeah, and I can understand that because I think with children in particular, you know, there's always, you know, some level of vaccine hesitancy. Parents care about their children. They're like, well, I don't want to give them something that hasn't been tested that might hurt them. Now, in order to get approved, it did have to get studied. So it was studied in that population. There weren't any major safety concerns that were identified. So it has been vetted for that group. But I understand that people are still a little bit scared just because of how young the children are. But I will reiterate that it is actually a lower dose than what is used in adults too.
Well, booster shots were initially recommended for adults 65 years and older, or anyone over 18 years of age with underlying medical conditions. Now the FDA is prioritizing authorizing booster shots for everybody who is fully vaccinated. So what does the CDC recommend when it comes to booster shots specifically today?
Mm-hmm. So as of today, the CDC recommendations are booster shots for certain adult groups.
Hmm.
So for the mRNA-based vaccines, you're eligible for a booster dose 6 months or more after your primary series. And that can be for adults who are 65 and older, those who are in long-term care facilities, and those who have underlying medical conditions, as well as those who have occupational exposure. So maybe those who are in healthcare or other essential workers. So there's actually a pretty large group of people who are already eligible to get booster doses. So the CDC chose the wording of certain groups should be vaccinated with the booster, and other groups may be vaccinated with the booster. So those who are 65 and older, long-term care facilities, and those who are 50 and older with those underlying conditions, those are in the should receive the booster. The others that I mentioned are in the may choose to receive the booster. For the Janssen vaccine, it's actually a little bit more clear-cut for that one. Anyone 18 and older who received the first dose is eligible for a booster. 2 months or more after that first dose.
Well, and speaking of the boosters, are they made up of the same thing as the original shot? And also, we heard a bit on Morning Edition about mix and match. Talk a little bit about that, and how does that really work out?
Yes, for Moderna, the dose is different for the booster dose.
Okay.
So it's actually half of the original dose. For the others, it's actually the same dose. When it comes to mix and match, a couple important points around that, though. One, we are only talking about booster. So with a primary series, you're still supposed to stick with the same thing. So if you get dose one with Pfizer, you're supposed to get your second dose of Pfizer. Where you can mix it up would be with the booster dose. So if someone got, say, a dose of Janssen and now wants to get one of the mRNA vaccines for their booster, they can do that. Kind of the standard of care is to give someone the booster that matches whatever their primary series is. But you do have the option, say, if there's some kind of like supply issue or the person has a preference for getting a different vaccine, that's completely acceptable now.
A lot of this begs the question for me, what about folks who are honestly concerned about the long-term effects of mRNA vaccines? Not the so-called rights under attack group or even traditional anti-vaxxers who've been around, but truly people who are genuinely concerned about the lack of data available on the long-term effects of these new vaccines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's an understandable concern. You know, I know a lot of people have kind of been in the watch and wait category of like, well, I might be willing to get vaccinated, but I'm going to kind of see how things play out.
Sure.
First. And so I think what I can say to that is, even though these are the first two that were approved that had that type of technology, that technology has been under investigation actually for quite some time as a potential vaccine target. So it's not quite as new as people think it is. We've had a number of people who have gotten these vaccines. I mean, millions of people in the U.S. alone have gotten these vaccines. It goes to billions if you go to worldwide. So we have a lot of kind of real world data at this point that's forming. And so that's something that's always being monitored. So if there's any major safety issues that come up, the CDC and FDA will stop and look at it and examine it.
Dr. Ashley Hannings is the Associate IPPE Director in the UGA College of Pharmacy. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
In 1946, four young black people, Dorothy Malcolm, Roger Malcolm, May Murray Dorsey, and George Dorsey, were brutally murdered, shot over 60 times by a white mob less than 30 minutes from Athens in Monroe, Georgia. One of the victims was 7 months pregnant. The case, a tragic landmark in American racial history, sparked mass protests in New York and D.C., for the first time, an American president called in the Justice Department to wield the power of federal civil rights laws in its investigation, but to no avail. For nearly seven decades, activists have been trying to solve the case. One source of information is the grand jury testimony, which has been kept sealed for 75 years. But this month, a Supreme Court committee decided not to take up the matter of whether to release grand jury testimony of extreme historical significance. Earlier this week, I spoke to GPB's Grant Blankenship, who covered the committee meeting. Here's our conversation. Why is there still so much interest in this case after all these years?
I think because it's unsolved. Despite the fact, we know that over 100 people testified before a grand jury back in the 40s about what they knew about this crime. Just the notion that there's this wealth of evidence in a box in the National Archives about this heinous, heinous event that could actually help us all as Georgians, as citizens, to kind of begin to make sense of it and even heal from it, I think that's what keeps it front and center in a lot of people's minds.
And who is this committee?
So the committee that was taking up this issue of grand jury secrecy and when it should or shouldn't be abrogated is the Committee of Rules and Procedure to the Supreme Court. Federal judges, their attorneys, professors, academics, they consider issues of how criminal justice procedure should work in the courts, and they make recommendations not only to the Supreme Court but also to Congress when they come up with a new rule, a new way we should do things. And so in this case, what they were considering was what traditionally has been considered sacrosanct, and that's that when a grand jury is done receiving testimony and it's made its decision, the goings-ons in that grand jury should be sealed forever. The question that the Morse Ford case provides us is whether or not that should always be true.
What would be the danger in releasing grand jury testimony?
Well, in more conventional cases, like say a grand jury that happened 3 weeks ago, right? I mean, you could easily see that in a conventional murder case, someone who testified to a grand jury could themselves be in the line of harm if people knew that they helped secure an indictment against someone in their community for murder, right? What the attorneys for the historians in the Morse Ford case have long argued is that since this happened so long ago, 1946, most of the people who could be harmed by any lapse in secrecy to what's in these documents, they're probably dead. Their argument is that there are pieces of knowledge in some grand jury testimony that potentially could be of such social worth, sort of like transformative in the way that we see ourselves as a society, that just securing that traditional function of a grand jury isn't the overwhelming necessity.
And does the fact that the committee has refused to unseal the testimony mean that there might be some explosive or damaging information in the testimony?
This committee wasn't necessarily taking up just the Morse Ford grand jury documents. They were considering a change to rules, like a recommendation to change all the rules for all grand jury documents. And for instance, like some of the options they kicked around were when a case is 65 years old, maybe we should automatically trigger the release of the documents then. Like that was one option. So that sort of thing. I don't think it says anything about what could be in those records in the National Archives. Nobody's seen them in 70 some odd years, right? Since 1946, they've been sealed away, or else we wouldn't be fighting this in court. So nobody really knows what's in it.
Where does the case go from here?
It's a good question. I mean, I think some of the people on this rules committee said probably the next step for this issue of grand jury secrecy is someday when some other test case comes down the pike that worked its way to the Supreme Court. It's just a question of what case that'll be. They've already said they don't want to hear the Morse Ford thing. Yeah, but we've certainly not heard the last of these folks and their quest for understanding.
Grant Blankenship is a reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. We spoke earlier this week.
Every day, NPR's All Things Considered includes news that keeps you ahead of the curve.
If this issue is not important enough for us to draw a line in the sand, what issue is?
Plus, the unexpected.
The wing, the skin, the neck, the heart, you're making chicken meatballs, cooking the knee cartilage.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley. Clark County School District Superintendent Zernona Thomas announced last week that she plans to retire at the end of 2022. Born and raised in Athens, Thomas has spent 31 years in public education and was brought in to replace former Superintendent Damond Means, who resigned in 2019 amid ethics complaints filed against him. Board of Education President Lakeisha Gant said the board will begin the search for Thomas's replacement when it meets in December. Here to talk about that, plus the rest of the weekend news, are Gwen O'Looney with WXAG and Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd. First of all, what should we look for in a school superintendent?
I think Zernona's understanding of this community and her longstanding involvement with so many aspects of the school system were part of what made her the perfect person to step in at this time. I think to avoid a learning curve, it would be great to have someone local that has been involved in our system and carries a lot of respect. Hopefully they'll have the humility and the wisdom and commitment that Zernona Thomas has shown.
Thomas was sort of brought in to right the ship after the turmoil of Demond Mean's tenure. And not only that, she has also had to oversee the district during a uniquely challenging period as schools have had to cope with the COVID pandemic. And Gwen, you touched on this a little bit, but how has she done?
I'm a fan of this woman. I think she's a true community hero for one, stepping in at this point, for handling very difficult issues in a way that everyone understood that she was doing the best that could be done, even though no one knew really what was coming next or, you know, what was the answers. I believe she did the best we could have asked.
Chris, let me ask you, what do you think the chances are we return to some instability and dysfunction after she leaves?
I think it's definitely possible. The school board is still trying to get their accreditation back. And so I think it's really important to bring stability. So everything is so controversial these days. COVID, the lack of, progress that some people don't have seen, that the school board really hasn't been making that much progress as far as, raising our test scores and things like that. So I hope that someone can really bring the leadership that the district needs.
Fortunately, she's given a year's notice, so.
That's what I was going to say. The school board has a full year of getting their act together and really defining what they want in the next superintendent in such a way that when they come on board, they have a strong group of unified people standing behind them. That should be the goal of everyone in this coming year.
Let's move on to the Athens-Clark County Commission, which voted Tuesday to approve new commission district maps to submit to the state government for approval. So what changes to the districts did we see?
Well, very few changes, actually. So this map is really about as conservative as they could possibly make it. They only made, the bare minimum changes to keep each district roughly equal in terms of population. So they made a relatively big change to District 2. So District 1 took a big chunk out of that. And then a smaller change to District 4 and 7. So District 7 gets a little bigger because it had actually shrunk over the past 10 years. And then District 4 gets a little smaller because it had also grown. And besides that, there are just very minor changes here or there. Several districts don't change at all. And yeah, so this was, done on short notice because, everyone got the census data late this time around. So it was just, they had to do a kind of a quick job and they ended up, I would like to see much bigger changes to this map, honestly, but that wasn't in the cards this time around just because there wasn't enough time. We have to get this submitted to the state government for them to either approve it or do whatever it is that they're going to do. And if we didn't submit anything, then the state government would just have kind of carte blanche to do whatever they want. And I kind of am not, I would be hesitant to let them do that, to change our maps that much. So yeah, I think it's good that we got something out and the districts may not be perfect, but they're fine. They'll work, I think, for another 10 years.
We did not see some of the political gerrymandering that we're seeing on the state and national level at all. They were very practical. As Chris says, it's very conservative. It's primarily based on population changes and does use familiar and easy to understand separation, lines. But I'm kind of like Chris in that I wish we had had a lot more time because we had an impressive election board was really committed to looking at this carefully and making some major changes. But I think that if there was no choice as far as time, and I think the state has not been considerate, with the new election laws that have been passed, the state does have a greater right than it's ever had before to intervene with local election boards. So I'm hoping that they leave us in the kind of situation that we've been in the past and that has worked well for us.
Right. They still have the ability to disregard the maps and submit their own. How likely do you think that is to happen?
I hope it's not very likely. Don't they have enough to do? Why do they need to mess around with our districts? But but it's possible, especially since the vote wasn't unanimous, the commission vote. So that maybe opens the door to it a little bit. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, Chris, you mentioned the vote wasn't unanimous and that commissioners Hamby, Thornton, and Wright all voted against the motion. What were their objections?
Their objections were a little mysterious to me. I mean, Allison Wright gave the most concrete reason to be opposed to it, which is that she didn't like that Grand Allen Drive was split down the middle. But that happens with, when you redistrict, like streets are often convenient boundaries between districts. So that doesn't really seem like a reason to oppose it, but at least she gave a reason. But I mean, the other two didn't really even give a reason. They just said they objected to the process and wish we had more time. And I agree with that, definitely. But I don't see why that's a reason to vote no on this, because otherwise you're just letting the state government draw the maps. So yeah, I didn't really understand their reasoning behind that.
Finally today, let's move on to the old West Broad School campus. It was named one of the state's 10 places in peril by the Georgia Trust for Historic Preservation this week. Now, this comes after the school board voted down a proposal that would have restored one 1938 building on the campus and build a new one to serve as an early learning center, in part because the plan would have knocked down a 1950s building that historic preservationists say could still be saved. Since then, the school district announced they will instead be renovating the old Gaines Elementary School building to serve as the site for an early learning center. How do you feel about the new plan for using that federal Head Start money?
Well, I'm all for it. One, there's no controversy about Gaines School being more easily renovated. And we want to do that within the timeline of the federal funding. The other thing is that I have said from the beginning that West Broad did not carry some of the qualifications of early learning centers, as far as space, as far as, there just were some questions about it from the very beginning. And so, Historic Athens is the reason that it's on the state imperiled list because of their advocacy. And it will be there for another day.
Yeah, as long as they get to use the grant money and we can spread out these early learning centers, like now we'll have some on the east side. I think that's great. And I hope that we can figure out something to do with the West Broad School. So I guess they're still going to be working on that.
That is all the time we have for the panel this week. Of course, we are off next week, but we'll see you again in 2 weeks. I do want to thank my panelists, Gwen O'Looney with WXAG and Chris Dowd with Athens Politics Nerd. Stay with us. We'll have more Athens News Matters after the break.
WUGA News is supported in part by listeners like you and by WUGA's Community Advisory Council, which is proud to support in-depth and informative news from the Athens-Clarke County Commission, Clarke County School District, and the University of Georgia, and every corner of the community.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Before we get to our next piece, a warning. Parts of this interview may be disturbing to some listeners. As social media platforms grow in influence over our lives, new research from the University of Georgia suggests hashtags related to self-injury may be increasing on Instagram. lead researcher of the study and associate professor at the University of Georgia's Department of Counseling and Human Development Services, Amanda Giordano joins us today. Welcome to Athens News Matters.
Thank you so much for having me and for your interest in this topic.
Can you define self-injury and self-harm?
Yeah, so self-injury is the intentional infliction of pain or harm to one's body without the intent to die.
Can you describe some motivations for self-injury and for posting about it online?
So what we see in the research is that some individuals engage in non-suicidal self-injury as a means of emotion regulation. That's really the most common motivation. So if I'm feeling bad or I have a lot of psychological distress or psychological pain and I'm not sure how to deal with it, by causing harm to myself, inflicting pain into my body, that could be a way of escaping from that psychological pain by focusing on physical pain. But there are some other motivations for self-injury, things like self-punishment. So for individuals who have hatred towards the self or self-loathing, it actually can also be used as a means of anti-dissociation. So if an individual experiences trauma, particularly chronic trauma in childhood, they may learn to dissociate as a way of surviving the trauma. And so by inflicting harm to oneself, that could jar an individual back into the present moment and can serve as a means of anti-dissociation. Another is just to communicate one's pain with others. So if they don't have the words to describe their emotional pain, sometimes by inflicting harm on oneself, that can be a form of communication as well. What we're seeing recently in the last decade or so, researchers have been looking at the prevalence of self-injury related content online. And we're finding quite a bit of research support for the fact that individuals are uploading NSSI related content, so non-suicidal self-injury related content online. And so as we see the prevalence of social media use, particularly among adolescents, so there's an average age of about 12 of when individuals begin engaging in non-suicidal self-injury, it just makes sense that we're seeing more NSSI related content online as well.
Your study looked at hashtags related to non-suicidal self-injury on Instagram. Can you tell us what you were hoping to find from the study and what you ultimately found?
So the purpose of this study, since we know that NSSI-related content is becoming prevalent online, we wanted to see how Instagram users were thinking about NSSI-related content. So we searched for five hashtags that often are associated with non-suicidal self-injury. So hashtags like cutting and self-harm. And we looked at the associated hashtag. And we went through and identified all psychologically relevant associated hashtags and categorized them. So our results were pretty interesting and a bit disheartening that we found the most commonly associated hashtags with the five hashtags related to NSSI content fit into the categories of suicide or depression.
Why is it concerning that social media users may have more access to self-injury content?
That's a great question, and it's a little bit more complex than you might think. So some people turn to online communities to talk about issues like non-suicidal self-injury as a way of seeking support. Others also post online to find reasons to stop or encouragement to stop, or people who've been through something similar, but then they were able to stop that behavior, and so they can offer advice about what worked. So that could be almost a beneficial side of NSSI content online. But the more negative side or potentially risky side is related to this concept called social contagion. So if an individual engages in a behavior like non-suicidal self-injury or a suicide attempt, sometimes there's an imitation of that behavior in one's immediate environment. And so we call that social contagion. And typically it's in one's immediate environment. But now that we have online access where you can see what people are doing across the globe, it could increase that social contagion to a much wider audience. The recent research reveals that although age of first non-suicidal self-injury experience is around 12 years old, age of first exposure to non-suicidal self-injury is between 10 and 11. So obviously these adolescents are becoming exposed to it either through movies or what's streaming on the media or online before they're engaging in the behavior themselves.
What can parents, guardians, or even peers do to help adolescents who might see self-injury content online?
There needs to be more information about what adolescents could potentially see online. So prior to getting online, it's important to just educate children and adolescents about what they might see and what to do when they come across those types of images or that content. And so by opening that communication, that can be really important. So adolescents don't come across something that they've never heard of before. They don't really have a schema or a mental category for, and then they think, oh, I might not have, I wasn't supposed to see that. So I'm going to keep it as a secret. And that can lead to just a lot of questions and curiosity or looking for information elsewhere when they could go back to their parents or guardians and say, this is what I came across. It was disturbing to me, or it elicited a lot of questions. Can you help me process this?
And what should parents, guardians, or even peers do if they know someone or if they are someone who self-injures?
Yeah. So what we know is that it's prevalent. Recent research has said that up to 17% of U.S. adolescents have engaged in non-suicidal self-injury. And there's a lot of resources available. So there are group treatment options, there are individual counseling options. There are a lot of professionals who have training in non-suicidal self-injury. So the first thing I would recommend is to broach the subject with the individual who may be harming themselves. So asking the question, showing that you care about their psychological state, and then helping them get connected to resources. But if we don't talk about it, and if we kind of look the other way and we never ask someone about their mental health or about some of these behaviors, then they might not ever get connected to these resources.
Amanda Giordano is an associate professor in UGA's Department of Counseling and Human Development Services.
The holidays are coming up, and with the uncertainty of the pandemic, many of us may still be using Zoom to connect with our loved ones as we did last year. That's the kind of Zoom call most of us look forward to. But what about the everyday work calls? Zoom fatigue is a thing, but if you start feeling burned out, the answer may be as simple as turning your camera off. Kathy Bradbury has the story.
Good morning, everybody. Let's get to the news. What do you guys know today?
Yes. I have a sound from the sheriff enough to do a full cast. So
excellent. And you want to keep that on in the
every weekday morning at 11, the WUGA news team gets together on Zoom to chat about local news headlines and to plan daily newscasts. This team has been meeting virtually since the beginning of the pandemic, and it's still the easiest and safest way for 8 people to meet. As many have come back to work and school, in-person meetings are making a comeback. One thing the pandemic has shown us is that whether we're working from home, working on different parts of campus, or even working in different parts of the state, Zoom is still a viable way to get everyone together. But are we reaching peak Zoom fatigue? Dr. Kristen Shockley, Associate Professor of Psychology at UGA, wanted to find out.
Zoom fatigue is a new term that's really come up just during the pandemic. And what people mean by it is that they're just exhausted after a day of being on Zoom.
So Shockley and her team conducted a study focused on one group of people working remotely to ascertain whether it was actually the Zoom meeting or being on camera for long hours that was fatiguing workers.
So we were interested in whether the Zoom fatigue factor is really a product of just being on Zoom, period, or if it's something to do with the camera itself. So we partnered with a company named BroadPath, and they allowed us to go into their organization and do this experiment. So we had half of their employees who participated in one condition, half in the other. It was a true random assignment field experiment. And so for 2 weeks, one of the groups had their camera off and the other had it on, and then they switched for the second 2 weeks. And at the end of each day, we measured their fatigue as well as how engaged they'd been in meetings that day. And ultimately, we found that on days when the camera was on, people were more fatigued. And in turn, if they felt fatigued, they actually performed worse in meetings.
What Shockley's team found out is that there's something about having a front-facing camera on during back-to-back Zoom meetings that seems to cause people to feel drained. And this phenomenon is more prevalent for new employees who are trying to make a good impression, as well as women in general.
The reason why we think camera's fatiguing is called self-presentation effects, because we're very conscious of ourselves when we can see ourselves on the camera, and we all care about looking good. So when you can see yourself, that sense of self-presentation is heightened, and it just drains your cognitive resources, which makes you tired. But when women are judged more harshly for the same thing as men, it's going to be even more cognitively taxing. So essentially, they're having to work harder, engage in more of that self-presentation. So overall, that leads to a more fatiguing effect. Also, there's the children factor. So we know that women statistically are much more likely to get interrupted by kids while they're on a Zoom call, or just family members in general. And so that could create additional anxiety that's kind of fatiguing over time.
Professor Shockley's study was scientifically rigorous, but I wanted anecdotal support. Luckily, I have a captive group for this case study just down the hall.
All right. So Monday morning, what do you guys know?
So news release from ACCPD, someone arrested for several incidents they think are related.
That's our news team again, except this time half the team has turned off their cameras.
When my camera's off, I don't care what I look like. Like, I'm not like worried about my facial expressions. But when it's on, I feel like I don't want to make a bad facial expression.
I don't think it's tiring at all, but that may be because you said the meeting's only 30 minutes long, typically. If it was a meeting that was maybe longer, I can see how I can grow a little fatigue with Zoom.
I had lots of 3-hour Zoom classes, and it was really difficult, especially when your camera was on, because you're just always on.
If I'm on a Zoom call and majority of the people have their cameras on, I'm more likely to have my camera on.
Dr. Shockley says it's okay to turn off your camera sometimes if you're feeling tired or strained.
I don't think Zoom is going anywhere now that everyone's got a taste of it. For me, it was sort of a freeing finding, like, hey, it's okay to have your camera off. And I hope that through the study, we can get that message out there and that people can become more accepting of the camera off and not just assume it means you're disengaged, because that's not what our study found.
The next phase of the study will investigate whether different camera angles, making your camera invisible on your computer while others in the meeting can still see you, or even replacing your image with an avatar or likeness, might reduce the feeling of fatigue.
It's so interesting doing research during this time because there's so many questions that are just truly new. And it's truly like things were shaken up in a way that's never happened before. And I think it's really exciting for the future of work.
For WUGA, I'm Kathy Bradbury.
You know that feeling where you're exhausted by the news, but you also can't stay away from the news? I am here to help with that. My name is Sam Sanders. My show is called It's Been a Minute. Every week, journalists and I process the week of news and culture in a way that doesn't feel overwhelming. Listen to It's Been a Minute every week from NPR.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Chris Shoup. Searching for Sequoia is a documentary about the life of Cherokee leader and scholar Sequoia, best known for creating the Cherokee syllabary, or writing system. The documentary is aptly named as producers, with the help of scholars and descendants of Sequoia, search for the details of Sequoia's life, his mysterious death in Mexico, and his lasting legacy. Here with us today is Leanne Howe, Edson Distinguished Professor in American Literature at the University of Georgia, and co-producer and writer of Searching for Sequoia. Welcome to Athens News Matters.
Thank you for having me on the show to talk about searching for Sequoia.
Can you talk a little bit about Sequoia and what drew you to this project?
James 48 and I were finishing a documentary in 2002. So at the end of our work, someone from the Eastern Band of Cherokees said, well, you know, there's never been a film on Sequoia. And he was a real innovator and a genius. He wrote the syllabary. I knew he wrote the syllabary, but I hadn't heard that there had been no work on him as an individual and the kinds of marvelous things he had done. So both Fortier and I put that little tidbit of information in kind of the back of our minds, thinking, oh, that's really interesting.
You tell about Sequoia's life through oral stories of five modern-day Sequoia descendants. Why'd you choose to tell the story in that way?
Well, both Fortier and I are Native ourselves. Mm. I'm a citizen of the Choctaw Nation. Fortier is Ojibwe from Canada, and we knew that, you know, Natives are nothing without family. You cannot be in a tribe or a Native community without a lot of family members, and so I know that from growing up in Oklahoma. So we knew to do this film, we would have to track down descendants and their stories about him, because that's the way the oral tradition works. Mm-hmm. And to be historically correct and factual, we also engaged with historians. I mean, it was a big, big project with lots of moving parts. And that's kind of how we pursued this subject of Sequoia and all the innovations that he was involved with and his travels to Mexico. I mean, think of that. And deciding to go down there because the Cherokee Nation had asked him to recover and bring back some of the Cherokees that had fled into Mexico. They were afraid of the federal government and Andrew Jackson's policies. And so it was, you know, he was really an amazing individual.
Well, and you're mentioning Mexico, which is where Sequoia died. His death is described as mysterious. Without giving too much away, why is his death mysterious?
Well, for years, people had assumed that he was just lost. Mm. And so there was a mystery around, oh, no, he went to Mexico and he was lost. He wasn't lost. But for a man his age, I think the journey is very difficult. Mm. As we talk about in the film, you know, we had trucks and equipment.
Right.
And we were staying in hotels, not laying out on the ground. But it was not an easy journey to get into Mexico and to record. And I just have to say this. The most shocking thing to me in all these years was when we went to Zaragoza and we came into town and knew we needed to find help. We went to the mayor's office and we had a translator with us. And she laid out why we were here, and he said, oh, yes, we all know Sequoia. Hmm. I'll show you where he's buried.
Wow.
And he could have knocked us all over with a feather, but we all almost had that deer in the headlights shock, because so many people here don't know, in the United States, do not know about him.
I want to ask about the title, Searching for Sequoia. Daniel Justice, Cherokee scholar and author, states, in some ways, the search for Sequoia is really a search for us. Can you talk a little bit about this quote and what it means to you?
It means that we are always searching for our people, lost over the Trail of Tears,
all of us that are Native from the five tribes out of the Southeast are always, in some ways, it's a search for us. We're looking for our ancestors. We're looking for our people, the root of our people, as so many people died on the trail into Oklahoma. And I believe that Jackson thought that we'd all die, that my ancestors, Daniel's ancestors, would die, you know, walking themselves to death.
Is that part of the drive, too, I wonder, for you, as far as preserving Sequoia? I mean, I can hear in your voice the passion of recognizing that not enough people know about him. Is that part of it, that there's inside of you a drive to say, you know, we are still here?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that and putting it so well. There is a drive in all of us out of the Southeast to do exactly what Sequoia was trying to do, reunite our people, our lands, and our stories.
Well, one thing that stood out to me is how many people on the production are members of not only the Cherokee Nation, but many others as well. Can you talk about how that shaped the final product?
James Fortier and I wanted to have an all-Native crew working, as many as possible. First of all, it's just good. It's good resources. We have lots of folks in the filmmaking business these days. But we also wanted to have people that understand what this means. Mm. And so we gathered a crew from the many tribes, predominantly Cherokee, but also from other nations. We wanted that sensibility in the crew on set because of its importance. However, though, I'd like to say that we had non-Indians working with us, and that felt just right as well. So they all were very integral to this production, and we're very grateful to them.
Leanne Howe is the Edson Distinguished Professor in American Literature at UGA and co-producer and writer of Searching for Sequoia. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News. Our producers are Martin Matheny, Gene Davis, Devin Zwald, Robin Whetstone, Kara Nelson, and Abby Buston. The opinions expressed on this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia. Don't forget, you can hear these stories and all of our previous work over at WUGA.org and get the latest local and national headlines on the WUGA app, available wherever you get your apps. And of course, we'd love to have you follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We're at WUGA FM. We'll be taking next week off for the Thanksgiving holiday to give our hardworking producers a few well-deserved days off, but we invite you to tune in at this same time next week for a compelling special from American Public Media, Uprooted, the 1950s Plan to Erase Indian Country. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup. As always, thanks for listening to Athens News Matters from WUGA News, and have a happy Thanksgiving next week.